Welcome to Speducation, the special education podcast by Speducators and for Speducators, where we discuss all things related to special education, or as I like to say, Speducation, from the point of view of professionals working in the field. I'm Sarah Perkins, a nationally certified school psychologist currently practicing in a junior high in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Leanne McElwain. I'm a special ed teacher at an elementary school and have a background in secondary schools as well.
In this episode, we continue with our book review of The Six Shifts to Improve Special Education and Other Interventions by Nathan Levinson, and we're on Shift 4, which is related to social-emotional learning and behavior. And this is the only shift that he dedicates two chapters to. The first chapter is sort of describing the problem, I guess, and the second chapter is more implementation. Now, it looks to me like he identifies social, emotional, behavioral difficulties as having six components. So the components are universal norms, social, emotional skills, trusting relationships, mental health students, severe behavior supports, and everyday discipline. And so he sort of talks about how you can do all of those. I thought that was a decent breakdown of the components. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It seems all-inclusive.
Yeah, right.
Comprehensive.
One thing I liked that he said is he said, like, for leaders, if you're addressing social-emotional learning without clarifying which domain, that would be a problem, because he sort of points out that, like, teachers want you to deal with severe behavior, but often the district or leadership wants to start at, like, tier one. And so if you just say, we're addressing behavior problems, then you're going to end up with morale issues, unless you say how you're addressing them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a good point.
Right, yeah.
Thoughtful.
That is. This is a lot.
It's a lot. Another thing that I thought that I, like, resonated with me and felt real is he said, when you have a hammer, everything's a nail, and that can happen with social-emotional learning. Like, you have one solution. I was thinking my school, I see it as, like, PBIS.
Right.
Or another one that comes up at my school is check in, check out. Oh, the kid's having behavior problems. Check in, check out.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, maybe, like, it's probably not ideal to just have one strategy, and that's how you respond.
Right, and it is interesting, and you probably know more about the communication right now in building an MTSS program. What types of interventions do you have? How comprehensive are they? What do you have at a tier one? It's fine to say you're starting at tier one. That's great. That's where it should start. But you should have programs that are visible.
Mm-hmm.
People are working in regularly, and you know that it's there's a vocabulary behind it. Every stakeholder is aware of what they are.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, in terms of an MTSS model.
Yeah, and I feel like in our district, I feel like that piece is sort of stagnant. More than a decade ago, we got Olveus for bullying, and it's just been Olveus for bullying forever. And then secondary, they sort of sprinkle in second step. But, you know, if you want, and it's sort of vague.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of district-wide, tier one, like, this is the way we're doing it. And like you said, it's visible throughout the school.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, like, PBIS a little bit. Would you agree?
Yeah. In connecting with that line of thought, when you are identifying someone at a tier three with emotional needs, you know, you've checked the box, yep, their behavior impacts their learning, the learning of others. How do these six areas align with identifying that need?
Yeah.
You know, like, what assessments, what interventions have already occurred, and how do you then address that?
I think that's a real area of growth, let's say, for our system.
Right. And it would be a question of him as a consultant to say, how do we do that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. He does say, like, he talks through the domains, those six domains. He sort of talks through them backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like his thinking is you're going to get more buy-in from educators if you start with severe needs, which I think is smart of him.
Yeah.
I think he's right.
Right.
And he says, like, so severe needs. One thing he says, which I guess feels true, but I don't know, he says that severe behavior is on the rise and starting younger than it used to, which I know educators say. I guess I wasn't necessarily clear that there was maybe empirical data to support that, but he says there is. He has I didn't write them all down, but he has statistics and whatnot he quotes. And then he says, like, this is, you know, this is where you do, like, your FBA and your behavior occurs for a reason, Ross Green, like, all that basic behavior stuff that SPED educators know. But he does talk about that SPED placement for behavior is sort of where kids go to never reemerge from. So touches on it, but then it's like, okay, but then what do you do so the kids just don't disappear into the behavior room?
Right. Yeah, he references Ross Green's work.
Yeah, which then, I like Ross Green.
Right, right.
So I didn't necessarily have any, like, problems with that domain. I was like, yeah, that's what you do with really severe behavior. But I didn't necessarily, like, learn anything either.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, he only referenced, he says, yeah, there's a science behind it, and then leaves it at that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he goes into domain five is discipline, practice, and policies for mild and moderate infractions, which I feel like we're maybe less clear on. Like the super severe SPED behavior, we usually have some handle on. And one quote that I wrote down that I really liked is, the repercussions for acting inappropriately shouldn't be less learning.
Right.
That made me happy. I was like, yes. Which, so that's like a pet peeve of mine, especially like when it comes to like, if you're tardy, we'll pull you out of class. Like one, aren't you reinforcing them not going to class?
I know.
And two, like, no, they need to go to class.
Yeah, it's like we're still surviving or functioning on that idea of shunning or shaming. Like, okay, you're not a part of the group now. And that is not teaching. It's not learning. It's not teaching.
Yeah. Right. And then he talks about, like, in-school suspension would be better, and you and with content-strong teachers. Right now in our secondary, in-school suspension is usually paras, and at elementary it's, like, office staff or...
Well, so my experience this year has been much different than has been years previous, and it actually, within our building, and I think it largely is dependent upon agreement of staff. But the special ed students typically will be with the special ed teacher.
Okay.
And then depending on the infraction, oftentimes they'll still go to interventions, they'll still go to specials. It just depends on what the nature of the infraction was. But oftentimes they're getting more instruction around what the problem behavior was, what the concern was, and then they'll go back into their classroom.
That's much better. Yeah, that is good.
It's really good. I think it's a great leadership model. And
that's awesome.
I do feel appreciated by the administrator and the behavioral intervention staff for stepping up. Like, it is recognized that, look, we realize you don't have to do this, but this is what we all believe is best for kids. And it does help, I think, parents to feel like the student's not just being pushed to the side.
That is really nice. And, you know, I have to give credit. Now that you mentioned that, it makes me think. I know, and I'm not aware of all the details, but I know that in my building, it is a para who manages in-school suspension. But they've been given a lot more tools. And so they have some online learning programs. One's called Ripple. And that's everything I know about that. But it's some sort of social-emotional learning online platform. And the students are supposed to, like, complete a segment of it to move out of ISS, and they also have a system where the students work on their classwork, and if they do work on their Ripple module or whatever it's called and do their classwork, they get to leave ISS early.
Oh.
And so it's reinforcing this, you're not just like sitting here and killing time.
Right.
And it seems to have been better in terms of, I've heard fewer complaints from the paras about, like, this is just a place where bored, naughty kids sit and are naughty. And the students seem to think, like, I go there and I get a lot of work done, but I also get to get out.
Yeah, so. It's not a life sentence. It's not like, oh, you know, this is, it sounds like it's empowering.
I think it is.
Gives them a way, I mean, they know also how to finish up early.
Yeah, they can see the path. It's not just this vague thing.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
It has been good. And I think I have to give credit to our paras who are in there, because that is a really challenging role, mm-hmm. and they don't get paid very much.
Right.
But I am glad they're getting, because I know our last year, our para who worked in that room did not feel supported at all. She felt, you know, they'd put, two kids would get in a fight and they'd send both those kids together to ISS. And she'd be like, I don't feel super safe.
Right. So, right. So they continue the fight.
Yeah. So it's been better. One thing he doesn't mention about ISS is like manifests and protecting students' rights around that.
It just doesn't go there.
And I wish, you know, maybe down the road for a future podcast, I wonder if there are any books or guidance on like how do districts actually deal with ISS and manifests, because it seems to be not a lot of great guidance. And it seems like ISS is sort of considered a manifest-free zone, and I'm not sure that that's right. But I will definitely rant about that, but not today.
It's interesting. I think that could be a doctorate.
Right.
Study.
Probably. Yeah. Absolutely. The other thing I thought that he meant, and I liked that he mentioned that maybe our district could grow in, and maybe our state, is he talks about like unconscious bias and disproportionality.
Yeah.
Which I feel like come up in our district a little bit, and people like mention it, but then I don't know that there's any concrete actions taken to address that it's mostly boys and mostly non-white boys who end up with disciplinary action.
Yeah, I feel a little shame around that, only because I think Wyoming, with as few people as we have, our population being lower, it's something that we don't necessarily have the impetus to address. And I think it applies to us. I just think, unfortunately, our state doesn't have to really directly deal with it until something very bad happens.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, we tend to, Wyomingites tend to think, well, we don't really, diversity's not really a thing, but, you know, it is throughout the state, and diversity can come in all different forms. It doesn't have to be just racial. Mm-hmm. It can be economic, it can be gender, it can be, you know, sexual identity, all of that. But also, you know, in all of our bigger metropolitan areas, which they're not metropolitan, but larger towns, let's say, I mean, there are people with, I mean, we've had in our school, we've had Somalian refugees. I've had Vietnamese families. I mean, so even in Wyoming, you get languages other than Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes it's like, okay, you know, broadly speaking, our state's mostly white. That's true. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change the fact that we need to be thoughtful about diversity.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
He also mentioned high flyer teachers and finding those, the ones who suspend the most or refer the most. Like, that feels like principal job, and that I don't want to do that.
I know. It is interesting. I do think, in my experience, it has fallen to administrators. I do feel like in my current placement, I am in a sense kind of more partnered with, in a way that I haven't been in the past. And I think that my current administrator takes it on herself in a very personal way. Like, I need to set this teacher up to be successful as well. So, well, like, you're not giving them an easier job. You are maybe providing them some supports that maybe another teacher wouldn't get, to try to keep everyone successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is nice.
Yeah.
No, it's good. I mean, especially in our teacher hiring crisis, it's important to for staff to feel like somebody's got their back. And
so true.
If things are going poorly, it's not just their problem to fix.
Mm-hmm. And I do think there's a lot of administrators that believe it is their problem to fix, but I'm glad to be working with one currently that does not fully believe that.
That is good.
Yeah.
I think that sort of goes into the next domain. Domain four is building trusting relationships between adults and students. I think this was my favorite because it made me, like, there were several things that they said in here. I'm like, oh yeah, we could do that. Like, they talk about a social data meeting where you like put up, they said each kid. And I was like, I don't think I have a wall space for 600 kids, but each kid, maybe you could do it by core or something, make it manageable, and ask, like, what are their hobbies? What do they do after school? like who's in their family, what do they want to do when they grow up, who are their friends, and then have staff go around and write the answers to questions. And then if you have a kid who has none of the questions answered by any staff members, mm-hmm. you like say, this somebody needs to like notice this child. Mm-hmm. And I liked that idea. I have a feeling that maybe junior high staff would think it was hokey, but I think you could strong arm them into doing it.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard of that a similar project being done at one of the high schools in our district, and they had a space where they put all the students' names, and then each of those students had to have a staff member's name next to it, and then they were kind of responsible for being like a mentor or a connecting
point. That is nice.
And then that helped them identify those kids that did not have that.
Yeah.
And I think it was very powerful. I don't think it's still happening.
I feel like that, when I first started at the secondary level, that was sort of the idealized vision of the advisory, like our mm-hmm. homeroom time. Mm-hmm. But then it just sort of devolved into this half hour of empty space. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea was like that teacher is your person who's making sure that you've got what you need.
Right. I think that is the underlying purpose of advisory.
And so yeah. I bet there's some advisories out there, like in my building right now, where the teachers could tell you something personal about every student. But mm-hmm. I'm also certain that there are several advisories where that's not the case and where the kids just play on their phones, even though they're not even supposed to have their phones.
I know.
So I would love to see maybe more structure. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree. I think it's doable. Mm-hmm. And if we structured it differently. The other thing you mentioned around that was he said like all in the hall, which they say on the intercom all the time at my school, all in the hall during passing. But the reason it's stated is for like to monitor problem behavior.
Right.
He says for small talk, for connection with students.
Oh, interesting.
And that I was like, that would be such a small tweak that would bring just a different yeah. morale mm-hmm. and positivity. Like you're not here to be like, bad, stop it. But like, hey, right. are those new shoes? You
right.
know?
Right, right. And some teachers' personalities easily lend towards that. So even if they're out there supervising to keep things mellow, they're doing that anyways. But I think it would be powerful to change the lens a little for the majority of the staff. Like, because you even put staff on edge by saying, all in the hall, and then inferring that it's to control fights or it's yeah. to control violence or it's to, whatever. Because really, I've always thought of all in the hall related to OVAIS, our OVAIS bullying mm-hmm. program, because you have hot spots where negative behaviors occur or bullying occurs. And so that's where I've gone with it. I've
yeah.
never gone with it in my mind to like, oh, create small talk.
But yeah, community building.
Right. No,
yeah.
I've never thought of
it. I know. That's why I wrote it down. I was excited. I was like, yeah, why couldn't it be that?
Right.
Instead of, and especially like at my school, they do it over the intercom to like, hey, remember teachers all in the hall, which teachers, I mean, I admit I don't go out every single passing period. So the reminder's good. But also if the reason we're supposed to do all in the hall is to ensure safety, then when it goes over the intercom, sort of the unspoken message is this place isn't safe mm-hmm. to both the students mm-hmm. and the staff. Mm-hmm. So if it were framed, and maybe explicitly to the students, the staff want to know you, they're going to be in the hall so they can know you and so that we can build community.
Right.
Then when the intercom went out, remember all in the hall, mm-hmm. it would be, don't forget to say hi to your students and
right.
have those friendly, non-contingent, non-academic moments.
Right. Like I'm thinking, at conferences when you have to match up with someone with the same shoes or
yeah.
you have to match up with someone the same hair color, and you're all told the reason to do that is to connect and answer this question mm-hmm. or whatever. So if you said, remember, talk to 5 new people
yeah.
during this passing period, or talk to 3
yeah.
new people, whatever, that's a more community building.
Yeah,
idea.
I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
That is a good idea. One thing that my school has done related to this, they mm-hmm. just did it this past like month or two, is they did this 5-to-1 initiative, which we've all heard about 5-to-1, but they actually tracked it. They created a spreadsheet with all the staff names on it, and the staff were supposed to log when they said something positive to students, and then if you were support staff, like me as a school psychologist, I was supposed to log saying positive things to staff, and you typed it into the spreadsheet, and then the people with the most positive statements, which was self-reported, they got, we all clapped at the last staff meeting, and they got, I think, like a duty-free advisory. They got some sort of prize or a gift card. Mm-hmm. I think it depended. They did individuals, and they did cores, and they did paras, and it was, so I think you could implement all those things together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do your 5-to-1s while doing all in the hall.
Right.
Do them to somebody you don't teach.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. That's exciting. Do you know who led that initiative?
That was my principal.
Okay.
And she was trying to boost morale in the school for both staff and students, which, frankly, I think trying something new and positive in March as a principal... Props.
Kudos.
Yeah, that's hard. So yeah. I'm impressed. Like, even just trying is winning in that case, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, a lot. And then, they said teacher lunches, and it's like check-in, check-outs. Like, these are all things we could do. And if we just tweaked some things, like, what if you know, we have duty-free lunches, and that's part of the contract, and that's union. But what if you said, hey, you don't have to have an advisory, but you could, but you eat lunch with kids?
Yeah.
You know, and then have teachers, and maybe you could rotate them out so that, and the teachers eat lunch in the cafeteria so all the students can see Mr. Jones, who's that sort of weird science teacher, but he's like chilling eating a sandwich with his kids.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like there's ways you could work it if you tried.
I love that idea.
Yeah. So this was definitely my favorite domain.
Different ways to meet that same need that then allows staff to have some control over how they're doing it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Cool.
Domain 3, I found a little disheartening because it was super short. It's like mental health counseling, substance abuse support, and social work services. And it's half, a little more than half a page. And it's like, we don't have enough.
Yeah.
The end.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
But as somebody in the mental health profession, I was like, that's great.
Right. And then he says that last statement, it goes into the next chapter. So we'll look at it there. But I mean, so he gives it a whole nother...
That's true.
But that will be interesting to go further in.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And then for domain 2, he talks about social-emotional competencies. So that's sort of like the SEL curriculum, which I believe he goes into more in the next chapter as well, like learning grit, empathy, cooperation, all that jazz. And he references CASEL, the Collaborative Academic Social and Emotional Learning. It's like a website where you can go and they rate programs based on how good they are. So I've gone and looked at there. It's a useful resource. I'll put the website in the show notes so people can go and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nonprofit and they just provide, you know, what evidence do they have? Have they done this or that in their program? What age range? Sort of a good, like a consumer reports type of thing for curriculum.
I'm just curious, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but have you compared that, or do you know much about how it compares to PBIS World?
I don't know much about it. I think, I'm not sure. I mean, is PBIS World, is maybe, I wonder if it's maybe tied to like a company that sponsors PBIS? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wonder, well, yeah.
I'm not sure.
Because I think PBIS World has a... If I'm thinking correctly, it has a space where you can say, these are the concerning issues, these are the potential responses. Mm-hmm. So we'll look at that.
Yeah, we'll have to... Well, maybe we'll put both of those on our show notes so people can take a look and see. There's also, like, Intervention Central is another website that goes through, like, just various tools you can use. It'll, like, reference programs you can pay for, but also just... Here's an idea of an intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of different tools that you can use. So, but that's the one he mentioned.
Okay.
And then the last domain is universal behavior expectations, like tier 1 and classroom routines. And he says that we're mostly doing okay on this, which I guess I guess this is sort of like teacher 101.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And he says secondary schools are more likely to have clear universal rules, but they were less likely to be universally applied as teachers have a lot of agency. And I would say I agree.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I think secondary teachers as a species tend to be a little bit like their students and don't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And elementary, I sort of always feel like the culture of the staff changes similarly to how the culture of the students does with the ages.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, I would agree.
Mm-hmm. And one thing he says in this domain one, I really wanted your input on, Leanne, is he talks about structuring unstructured time. And he gives the example of like a silent passing period or shortened to 1 or 2 minutes. And it reminded me of when I worked at after school program, we had to have a transition activity for any time we transitioned. So if we took all the kids to the bathroom, we should be playing a game in the hallway while they're going to the bathroom. So, which worked pretty well. But then he has like a structured recess, like every unstructured time should be structured. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Hmm.
Right?
It's a lot.
Right?
I think there are unstructured times because we already structure a lot of time. It does seem like maybe if you did structure the unstructured times, they would be less needy, right? Like you would have less issues during that time. But I also think I would be interested to hear what the least structured, unstructured time can be, because kids need creativity, right? So it's like, what does it involve? Does it involve, okay, you could put games out on a, could you really be hands off by just putting games out on a table and letting kids know the expectation is that they're doing one of those?
Yeah.
And then you're hands off. Where are you allowing kids the time to
just practice being kids?
Yeah.
That was my concern as well. It made me think, like, when I run lunch groups, I had a staff member tell me that they were concerned that when I ran lunch groups, I wasn't interacting enough with the lunch groups because I was talking to another staff member. And I said, well, it's not my job to socialize. Like, they don't need to learn to socialize like a 40-year-old woman. They need to learn to socialize like a 13-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. And I can't teach them that, but I can put guardrails. Mm-hmm. So I let them talk, and then I'm like, okay, we don't say that word in my office, or oops, I think you hurt your friend's feelings, but I try to mostly stay out of it.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's more structured than like the actual lunchroom.
Yeah, so they are getting something additional.
Yeah.
It does make me think that you could intervene or provide interventions based on what skills the kids have shown you they can handle.
Mm.
So maybe not everyone in the building would require the level that, you know, your lunch group requires.
Yeah.
But they're, I mean, so maybe unintentionally we're doing that, but not across the board.
Yeah.
Right? Because we identify kids for different academic. In the school that I work in, we call them academies. And based on teacher data, observations, and referrals and all of that, they identify, this committee will identify what kids go where, what academy they're in. And usually that happens like a lunch group.
Mm-hmm.
So they're working on it maybe once or twice a week. So we're doing that a little bit, but in terms of tier one, structuring unstructured.
Yeah, like a universe. I'm just trying to visualize. I feel like it would just be a really different school, a really different culture if we had like universal silent passing periods at a junior high. Like, because passing period is, that's often why some of my friends come to school. Like, they come for the social interaction during passing period.
Right, and taking that away, I don't know that the author would see it as taking it away. Maybe the author would see it as providing structure, which the kids are expressing that they need. But I don't know that everybody needs it.
Right. And I feel like the kids who need that social interaction, if that's what they're going to find it.
Right.
And so if you don't provide that moment, then they're going to go to in the bathroom. Like, I almost wonder, wouldn't we rather have a 3-minute unstructured passing period where they can get their social needs met and, you know, say hi to their girlfriend or whatever, then them sneaking out of class and meeting their girlfriend in some corner that doesn't have a camera.
Right.
Like, you know.
And then I think also we provide late passes, early passes to students who have indicated or expressed a need to do so. So I think, you know, I just don't think ever, I don't know if he just intended to say that this is a necessary need or whatever, but I feel like that would not be a battle. I would much rather address the need for quiet for the kids that need that than across the board implementing a quiet a silent passing period.
Yeah.
Well, I would like it as an adult.
Right? I mean, it'd be lovely.
I don't think, like you're saying, the issues that would arise. And maybe we're just fearful.
Yeah.
Maybe we're thinking that would happen.
But frankly, like, even the adults use passing period to check in on one another.
Yeah.
Like, I would foresee that if you did a silent passing period, that the adults would be talking to one another. And they would be the ones, I mean, not only them, but they would be the ones violating the rule.
Yeah.
Because the adults, especially teachers, are so isolated.
Yes.
And they need, like, a moment to be like, hey, just so you know, mm-hmm. Joey's dog died yesterday, and he's a bit of a mess. So when he comes to your fifth period, FYI.
Yeah.
Like, it could be really professionally relevant.
Right.
Or it could just be, hey, just so you know, my dog died, and I'm having a moment.
Right.
Can you just acknowledge that that's hard for
me?
Right,
exactly. You know? Yeah, just that. And it, I mean, similar to tie back to the previous discussion, if you can switch the lens a little bit, for how teachers are using that time, rather than say be silent, maybe you're building relationships.
Yeah. So that part I was like, yeah, I don't like it. So then the next chapter is when he talks about the implementation. So hopefully he does a deeper dive on some of those sections that he didn't really get into. One thing he talks about, and I think that you and I have seen this play out, is that staff believe shifting to prevention rather than discipline is being soft.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that maybe that comes up more at secondary.
I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, because you're... So for the nice thing about the elementary grades is that you're acknowledging that they have not learned everything. So you give them that grace, right? You're just saying, oh, they still haven't learned it. And they're smaller than you typically, so you automatically feel like you could care for them
mm-hmm.
more, you know.
I completely agree. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that is definitely like something a leader would need to be thoughtful mm-hmm. about moving into changing the social emotional interactions towards prevention. They'd need to be thoughtful about how to get staff on board
mm-hmm.
because they do say, so nobody even cares. They just send him back to class, right?
Yeah. I shouldn't laugh.
No, but we've heard it. I think, mm-hmm. you know, and that they say that staff need to believe they can help students with their behavior
mm-hmm.
and that different students need different things. So sort of that mindset shift for the grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And I still hear that from speducators. Like, well, it's not fair if he gets that when nobody else gets it. And it's like, well, it is fair. Like, by definition, our kids get stuff that other kids don't get. And just because it's in the context of behavior doesn't mean it's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does mean maybe you need to be thoughtful about how to manage that in your classroom if the other kids are like, why does he get to take breaks?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean it's not fair.
Right. I've had, so in that academy structure that I was mentioning, I've had students say, why do I have to be here over, you know, other students? Like, why do I come to this academy versus getting to do what they're doing? And really, I express to them it is to help them be successful. I do think that I have said, as soon as you demonstrate, can show us, and I don't necessarily like it to be like a checklist that they have to show us these skills, but, you know, really it's like, when we know that you don't have this need, we will address it and shift,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that's what good PLCs do. You know, you look at the data, what is the data telling you, and then you adjust. So I think luckily, I think our academy program, and I know he mentions MTSS in here,
mm-hmm.
I think it addresses those needs, responds to the data, you know, and then you adjust again.
I like that you're doing that at your school and sort of having those real conversations with the kids, because I think often at elementary, but even at the secondary level, we tend to tell kids like, oh, well, like, you're not different, or you don't have different
mm-hmm.
needs. Like, we don't want the kids to feel othered, which
mm-hmm.
of course we don't want kids to feel othered.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's like, they know, and if
mm-hmm.
they can see I'm being treated differently, like, we can acknowledge, yeah, that's because you have a need in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And like, let's just own it and work mm-hmm. on it together, and we're going to grow, and you're going to grow, and I'm going to help you.
Yeah. And there's no shame in it. Right. I mean, now it was sixth grade, you can have different conversations mm-hmm. with sixth graders than you can a first or a second grader. But I do think it's wise to, that's part of caring for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And have that conversation. Like, actually, it would be uncaring of me to see you acting out in these ways and then not address it with you.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I like that a lot. He talks, and then he goes into sort of like guidance around implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And he has these three, he calls them three lessons from the field. I liked these. I thought they were thoughtful. He says, don't do too much at once.
Mm-hmm.
And he outlines sort of each area of social emotional intervention that you could do. And then the tier. And he says it could add up to a lot of efforts. So there's this table where he says, like, behavior management. If you try to tackle that at all three tiers, then that would be, you know, multiple different interventions. And then if you did school norms at all three tiers. And so now you're trying too many changes at once in a school. He does say, ideally, it should be district-wide focus, which I think is unlikely to happen in our district culture. Our district culture seems to really value building autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we had a different culture, it would be lovely to have district-wide guidance that we're really just going to narrowly focus on doing this one thing well for in SEL. That would be lovely.
No matter what school you go to.
Yes. Because I could, yeah, because then that way the students know at every school they're really, you know, super into school norms.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about that. I have seen some growth. Like, I think pretty much every school in our district uses the PBIS, Safe, Responsible, Respectful.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So that's positive.
They do, but I feel like, to support what you're saying, I think it's largely staff dependent. And then also schools can get identified subtly and covertly as like, oh, this school, like, for whatever reason, this school's kind of the rescue bunch, you know, like, oh, really tough kids can go to that school and they succeed, or they at least get through, you know.
Yeah, it's like, absolutely. Another thing I see in our district that he mentions is not blurring the tiers. He says it's important not to have tier two strategies for tier three problems or vice versa. And I see that a lot, and I wonder if that's related to the whole if you only have a hammer, everything's a nail thing too. Like, if you only have a tier two strategy, then you're going to use it to solve all the problems. Like at my school, like I said, the big strategy in my school is check in, check out. So whether a kid is tardy, or he's getting into fights, or he's not doing work, or he's crying all day, the answer is check in, check out.
Right. And are we doing that because, yes, there's power in check in, check out, and that's how we're building relationships? So, I mean, we always say relationship first, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then I wonder, in terms of like shifting things like structuring passing periods, if we're building relationships in other ways, would we rely less on check in, check out, right? Like,
yeah.
Then you're building capacity.
Yes.
And adding interventions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think my school right now, and I'm not, I mean, this is just a weakness. I think we have tier three teachers teaching tier two interventions. And then when it comes to tier three, what's tier three? You know, then, and so I actually had my principal, so we had a student who was identified initially as qualifying for special ed. That student was already in my intervention. And so then, rightly so, my principal after the IEP meeting said, well, we have to be careful about saying, well, we're going to continue doing what we're doing if it was tier two.
Yep.
But then what is tier three?
I think yeah.
I think it's reasonable as a tier three instructor to say, well, what is tier three? Like, I get it. And the principal said, especially if the student is not growing. Luckily for me, the student is growing.
That's positive.
So it's like, oh, well, yeah, so my interventions
are working.
Maybe actually tier three, and they're helping early for tier two kids, right?
Yeah.
Also, that student needed something more that she's not getting from me, so I'm able to up in the area of math,
mm-hmm.
which I was not addressing.
So
for me,
it worked out.
Yeah, inadvertently, I incorrectly said, well, we'll just keep doing what we're doing, and didn't identify in that statement, oh, but we are increasing math, even though I had covered the new special ed services, it wasn't as clear for the parent. It wasn't as clearly stated. So that's something mentally I will be more aware of going forward. But it's so, I think it's so common.
I think tier two is like truly the middle child, because we have people who are tasked explicitly with tier one, and we have people who are explicitly tasked with tier three, but we often don't have explicit tier one, tier two staff. Like that this is Miss Jones and she does tier two, which means who does tier two? By definition, it's either tier one or tier three people,
right?
Because there's nobody who's being paid as necessarily, especially your school's not a Title I school, so nobody's being paid as a tier two staff member. So we have to figure out how to do it with tier one and tier three staff, but make it not tier one or tier three, and that's tricky.
Yeah, I do think we are a title school.
Oh, are you?
I also know we have met our AYP.
Oh.
And so we're losing staff now.
And so, you're being punished for meeting your goals.
And I think that's what happens. And it's pulling from tier two.
Of course it is. Because it's the middle child. Like, tier two gets no love. And then everybody's like, well, MTSS isn't working in your building. It's like, well, tier two is getting no love. Like, the system is set up to not allow for MTSS if there's no tier two.
Exactly.
Because that's the crucial tier, but it's the middle child.
Right. And it reminds me of a further discussion where it's easy to pay or identify staff positions that are funded through SPED, Tier 3, and then expect those people, right, to kind of water down into, or trickle down into impacting Tier 2. But it doesn't. It doesn't do that.
No, it doesn't. So, well, and it's unfair to Tier 3. Like, if we're saying they're the most intensive needs, don't water it down.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that relates actually to the next point he makes, which is about overloading the staff. So I think, so one way you can overload the staff is by having them trying to cover too many tiers, for sure. And then he also talks about like streamlining process and paperwork. I love paperwork. But I really liked this section because I was like, this has never come up. And I'd, in my buildings, and certainly at a district level, and I'd maybe love to have this conversation. Like, he has this process mapping where he says, identify every step in a common meeting, an initial IEP. And he says, go through each step. So not just like give assessments, but select assessments, gather materials, find a room, test the kids, score the assessment, write the report. Like every step, outline how much time does it take, and then go through each step and can it be eliminated? Or could fewer people do it? Something like that. And then he says, go through, you know, the time it takes. And then, are some people doing it faster? And why are they doing it faster? And could we learn from them? And, or he said that often people think, oh, well, doing it faster is maybe not best practice or not legal. And he says, but often that's actually not true. That's just a fear. And so if you investigate that further, you can find actually, no, it is good. And this has been an ongoing frustration for me because I find that there often are really good ways to streamline things. Like, for example, I have a add-on to my Word at my work computer that assists with report writing and templates that it was designed for lawyers, but it will automatically put in the correct pronoun and the student's name and does all these things. And as far as I know, actually your psych and we're the only two who have it in the district, cost $69 for a lifetime subscription. Like, it's nothing. And I'm not clear why we're the only two who have it when it's like really easy to use. And it makes it so that you like you never have to like go through the report line by line and make sure you change the she to a he.
Gosh. So I'm thinking as a special ed teacher, I should have that.
Yeah.
Like, it's, because it keeps you from making those silly errors that make you look incompetent.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, there's no venue. I wish there were a venue in our district, and maybe even in my, I mean, I guess I could do it in my building moving forward, to learn from the quickest or the, you know, the most efficient. Like, here's a space where you can go for like the awesome resource. You know, I've noticed that Susie can, you know, turn them out in an hour and it's taking me 5 hours. What is Susie up to? Oh, look, there's the spot electronically or physical or whatever where Susie shares her magic. Like, that would be lovely.
That would
lovely,
be so helpful.
Right?
I know.
So when I saw that, I was like, yes, please, let's do that.
So that to me, and tell me what you think, and it makes sense because I think you'll tell me, I think this is his background, but it seems like that should be driven from a human resource lens. Like, our human resource department could be helping the entire district by saying, let's learn from one another.
I think you're right. And I wonder if he's bringing, because he has such a business background.
Yeah.
Because that seems like a business thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like schools don't often look at, like, efficiency.
No.
Which.
Sometimes they, I don't know, they undermine it.
They write. And yeah. I feel like I don't want to value efficiency over student, mm-hmm. over humanity. Like, mm-hmm. we are, you know, a service-oriented public institution. We're not a business. We don't have
right.
a bottom line, but I think there's parts of, like, the business world that we could learn from. And, like, one is, let's look at efficiency. And I am certain that there are people who are very efficient at, like, writing an IEP and people who are not at all.
Right.
I mean, I'm clear so that that's true in my building.
Right.
Let alone in our district. And so could we learn from them?
Fascinating.
Yep. Right?
Yep. I think we could.
Right. And then related to that, he also, you know, he has these little titles. I like them where he says, like, let the most skilled counselors counsel. Seek out behavior specialists who are truly specialists. And it's sort of like, let people do what they're good at.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's interesting because I think we've touched on this before because he mentioned it before, right? With kids going to the teachers that are the highly qualified to teach that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a PLC idea. But then it's on the backside, how do you keep building capacity
in all your staff?
And not, I guess he says right here, I mean, learn from the quickest, right?
Yeah.
Like, so at some point he is saying, take time to learn from others and build that in.
Right? I wish, maybe one way that could be done is I wish there were a system, and maybe it could be done on a building level, where there was, like, PD, where we learn from each other. I feel like in our district, and we tend to have, like, money's not a problem, which outside of Wyoming, I apologize that money's probably a problem. But in Wyoming, money's not a problem. So we hire trainers and we bring them in. But I think sometimes it might be more useful to let Mrs. Jones stand up and share her process for writing an IEP,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to be more relevant to the rest of the teachers.
Yeah, and I'm thinking this could be an area. I mean, okay, in my building, the SPED team, there's only three special ed teachers and then a life skills teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So four of us. So because of the way we are naturally learning from one another, and that's encouraged from the administrative,
mm-hmm.
you know, realm. So we're all naturally doing that. And I think for the most part, we're at ease and trusting with one another. So we aren't fearful of saying, I don't know how to do that, or you do that a lot better,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of thing. But I just feel like maybe it's more of a gen ed practice where they observe the other teaching.
Mm.
I have seen, like, our math interventionist went in and taught a math lesson to a class. And I think that was very powerful
mm-hmm.
on both of their parts. I haven't said, outside of paperwork, I haven't said, how are you teaching this student phonics?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have thought a lot about it this year because I currently share a classroom, and it has helped me to learn what the other teacher is doing because I can just, I mean, I see her.
Yeah.
We don't have walls, so I
yes.
see her doing it.
Yes.
So I have learned just informally from her through observation, and it has helped me to know building norms and just kind of what best practices are in the building.
Uh-huh.
And I was initially supposed to have my own room, which wouldn't have allowed me to have that. So sometimes I think about next year, and because we are losing teachers, that maybe I will have my own space. But then I think, do I really want my own space because I can't see?
That is the upside about sharing. I think that's a really good point. In our district, many of our schools are, like your school actually has a large special ed staff for an elementary school. Mm-hmm. Some of our schools have two teachers or even one right. special ed teacher. So the opportunity to do that is even more limited.
Right.
And so then we would really need to be thoughtful about structuring. You know, made me think, like, could we have schools team up? Like, maybe the psychs could team up, or, you know, otherwise schools could maybe just team up and get together and talk, or, you know, get half-day subs and have people go over. Just opportunities to have that learning from the best moment. And, you know, and acknowledging you're good at this and I'm good at that. Let's get together and both be good at both things. I think that would be lovely, but it would definitely require some structuring for especially our smaller buildings. Like
right.
At both of our schools, actually, we are well-suited because we do have larger populations. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I've worked at schools in the past where we had only one SPED teacher. And I actually told my principal when I worked at one of those schools the past couple of years, they were hiring a brand new SPED teacher. And I said, is there any way we could put that teacher at a school with another SPED teacher? Like, I don't know that we can help grow them professionally as much as they deserve to grow when they'll have nobody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up, then the teacher, he was a fine teacher. I wasn't judging him. I wanted him to have that chance. And actually the school I was recommending he would go to was a shared building where this SPED teacher shared a classroom. Mm. And I was like, oh, that'd be perfect.
Yeah.
Because he'd have a mentor right there.
Right.
And it didn't work out. But I wish that was a consideration when he'd been hired.
Yeah, it's not, and it's not comfortable. I would say I did not necessarily want to share a space. Because it's hard, right? You have groups working at the same time, and, you know, it also, professionally, I think it speaks to how valued you are for how much space you're given.
That's a very good point, because only SPED teachers are sharing rooms.
Yeah.
And that's true at my school right now. They're not teaching in the same room at the same time, but they don't have their own rooms, and they, like, overlap and move, and only SPED teachers are doing that, and that is a morale killer.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
That is a really good point. Let's see. So then he also talks about, I do think it's funny, he says, consider small groups, and he acts like this is like a really, like, hot take. Like, oh, small groups. And it's like, yeah, no, we know about small groups. I was not
right.
impressed. I was like, have you been to the school?
Right.
Like, they do that.
Right.
And then he mentions community partnerships, and I was just thinking, one, a little hard when your state's a mental health emergency, hot zone, the entire state. Like, there's not a lot of community agencies to partner with. And also, our district has shot itself in the foot with some district policies that don't allow community service providers into the school building during the school day. I think that's too bad.
And they are actively charging other organizations to use our spaces.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, shooting themselves in the foot, I think.
Yeah, really disappointing. And then the last one, which I thought was a really good point, is he says, don't assume success, measure and adjust. I really liked, given that I'm married to a data scientist, proactively collect baseline data. Like, before you start, decide what data you're going to use and collect it then. Then start so you can see what happens. Because what often happens and drives my husband batty is a program is implemented and then halfway through they're like, we want to know if we've made a difference. And he's like, should have thought of that before you started. Now it's hard to measure.
Yeah. In grant writing, you have to say what the initial, right? You have to say what the initial measure is, but maybe most of the time we don't.
Well, and I think, again, this is one area where having more money causes unintended consequences because we don't necessarily have to apply for grants in our district.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just throw something at the wall without necessarily fully thinking. If in doubt, buy a curriculum or hire a new staff member with a new title without thinking through how will we know if this person's done a good job? How will we know if this curriculum's made a difference? So I really liked that. Not sure beyond just saying, yeah, do it, how like we as educators at the building level
yeah.
could actually use that information. But yes, like
right.
that.
Yes, I agree.
And then he finally ends with pay attention to overlapping impacts like schedules, which the entire book review we've been talking like schedules.
Yeah.
So it's a good segue to the next shift, which is schedules. So we finally got to the thing that has been bothering us all along. So next time we'll definitely have to talk about schedules and how, if his ideas for schedules are actually something that seems usable to us.
Education.